Let's have the discussion. You're listening to Canter with Scott and Paul.
Hello and welcome to Canter. Today we've got Jauke from Dutch Passion back with us again. Always a pleasure to have you on the show and chatting with us, Jauke. Thanks for coming on, mate.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Very good. So we're approaching summer. We're in summer for you guys. How's it going over there, bud?
Yeah, it's going very well, as you said, almost summer. So we have the plants on the balconies and in the gardens. Growing very well, vigorously. It's the time of the year where we manage to be are able to test our new strains outdoors. So it's exciting time. Our high season is getting over, so we still have quite a high volume of sales, but not as much as in spring, which creates some time for us to start planning for next year and the new catalog, new events, that kind of stuff.
Very cool. Very cool. Okay. When we did the history episode with you, you and I had a bit of a chat off air after we finished recording, and we were talking about the old days a bit, and you brought up the Super Sativa C Club, and they're an old school group that's just re-emerged, mate. What can you tell us about those guys?
Yeah. Super Sativa Seed Club is a project I'm very enthusiastic about. It's a long story. There's a lot to read about it. If you Google it, you will find quite some interesting information on them. But I can share a little bit the basic story of the Super Sativa Seed Club and also what we have to do with them. So actually, Super Sativa Seed Club was one of the first seed companies, even before Dutch Passion. Super Sativa Seed Club was founded in 1985. So 2 years before Dutch Passion. And in that time, they grew extremely fast. Those guys were really one of the few guys in Holland who were experimenting with breeding seeds. They started off with seeds they found in baggies, just like an imported wheat. But soon they went themselves to the US and managed to get some seeds in the USA. Actually, they didn't go themselves. They sent another guy for that. But they brought those seeds back to Holland, and here in Holland, where it was more liberal and tolerant, those guys were living, by the way, in a squat house. There were a lot of squat houses in that time in Holland, and they had free electricity there. And they developed the whole process of indoor growing. One of those guys managed to visit indoor farms in Holland, well, glasshouse farms where they had artificial lights. Holland always has been a pioneer in that also. And they just looked at those glasshouse professional farms, how they were growing on rock wool with artificial light and everything. And they brought it back to their squat house and used their free electricity to develop the indoor growing. In that time, there were no grow shops. No one knew how to do it. But they kind of developed that. They appeared a lot in High Times magazine at that time. Even the High Times guys came over to Holland, visited their indoor farms, made pictures, and it was one of the first articles ever in High Times about indoor growing was featuring their grow. So they were selling seeds. They were doing that worldwide. A lot of those seeds ended up in the USA. That's where they were most known. And they did that very, very good for quite some years. When the internationals' view on cannabis got a little bit worse, they decided in the early 90s from the one day to the other to close their company. So they just closed it, stopped selling seeds. They were feeling some heat and they felt, okay, now we can't continue anymore. And they went underground and they continued to grow for coffee shops. And one of the founders, his name is Karel. And Karel is actually quite known in the cannabis community as the founder of BioTabs. That's a company who produces organic nutrients. Yeah. So we at Dutch Passion, we knew that Super Sativa Seed Club existed, but we didn't know who was behind that. But we got to know Karel, I would say, around 4 or 5 years ago now. We started with friendly talks, and we spoke about seeds, and we realized that he knew quite a lot about producing seeds, which surprised us for a nutrient guy. But the talks went deeper and deeper, and we became some kind of friends. And that's when he revealed to us that actually he was one of the founders of the Super Sativa Seed Club. And when we figured out his reality, we started immediately to speak with him and his son, by the way, Case, who was also involved. Case is more of my generation, even a bit younger, I think. Case, Carol, me, and some more people at Dutch Passion, we got in talks about relaunching the Super Sativa Seed Club brand. And we also found out that Carol still maintained a 30-year-old sativa mother plant. So
wow.
One of the plants from the first day is still alive. That story is awesome. And they even had a police raid once where the whole grow room was wiped out. They lost all their genetics. But somewhere in the corner, there was still a piece of plant. And after the police came, someone brought them that piece of plant. And they managed to root it and to keep the mother. So that plant is really a survivor.
Wow.
That plant, by the way, is one of the parents of the strain that is being sold now as Case Old School or Keys Old School Hex. So you can look that up on the website. So anyway, so we started to speak about relaunching this brand because we thought like, wow, you guys have genetics, you have knowledge, you have a background, and one of the first seed companies around, which has been closed for a long time, but you know, the name was still there. Their genetics go around. Another famous name from them, for example, is Williams Bonder. But also Friesland in Canada, that's a very known strain. Purple Passion also. So there are several strains that are from their catalog that are still going around, you know. And they also maintained their own genetics. So, yeah, after some years, actually, of brainstorming, thinking like how we could do it, etc. In the end, we decided to go for it. And what those guys didn't really feel like was the boring part. So running a website, doing shipments, administration, all that stuff. They like to just work on genetics. But for us, that was fine because we already have that. You know, we are experienced with that. We have online department. We have a logistics department. We have like for each of those tasks, we have people with experience. So the only thing we needed to be able to launch that brand again was the seeds, and that's what they could deliver us. So we came to an agreement, and now we're working very closely together. And I think it's a very comfortable relationship in which they just have to worry about producing the best seeds possible, and we do the rest of the work. So. There's a website, supersativaseedclub.com. Their seeds are also available on the websites of many retailers that carry more brands. And yeah, if you want to try something special, I really recommend you to try one of their strange ones, especially the Carol's Haze. That's a really nice, potent, strong, old-school haze. Because that's another nice thing of this collection. They have new strains, and also the Carol's Haze is not the original one as it used to be. It was reworked. But they did maintain the terpene profiles from the old days. So, yeah, a lot of people like to rediscover these classic genetics, actually. And that's also something you find back in the son and the father who are breeding. You know, the father is bringing in more the old-school stuff, and the son is... Casey is really good in more the modern USA Californian strains. He's also expert in extractions, so that's a very very knowledgeable guy too. So yeah, that's briefly the story about Super Sativa Seed Club. I could speak hours about it, but at least I gave you an idea of what it is.
I think it's quite cool and refreshing that in the modern day of hybridization that there's still access to some of that old school stuff. Yeah. I think that's awesome.
Yeah, those guys have like some mothers, but also they have a big seed archive of old seeds. And we also have our own seed archives, but they have considerable amount of old seeds as well. So that's really nice. Yeah,
it's very cool. And when we talk about all this history and I try and vision, I guess, the progress of the Dutch the Dutch framework, and we talk about other places around the world, I just constantly think about how different countries approach their legal frameworks, and I just keep coming back to the same thing of what is an ideal framework, because I don't think any country's hit it. And I just really wanted to discuss with you, what are your thoughts if you were rolling out a system? How would you do it? How would you try and cater towards the people that are hesitant and concerned? And how would you also roll out an industry? How would you envision it?
Yeah, I definitely have some ideas about that. And also, I have to say that over my years working in the cannabis business, my ideas also changed about that. So. Because that has a reason. That's because over the last years, I've seen some countries who are very strict on THC, but they are very tolerant towards CBD. Mm-hmm. And actually, mm-hmm. I saw that CBD can play a big role in setting up a framework of legalization. So, but I think that. First of all, needs to be done, and that's fortunately in quite some countries already the case. But first of all, if a government is considering giving people more access to cannabis, I would definitely give those people the possibility to grow something at home. You know, when you grow a small quantity of cannabis at home, and you tolerate, or well, the best is just to legalize, allow that. Anyone can grow for themselves. And, you know, there are countries with rules like 1 square meter of grow, or countries who have, for example, 6 or 5 plants. There are also countries where the number of plants is not limited, but the production quantity is limited. So you can produce maximum 250 grams or 500 grams or a kilo. So there should be some kind of limit. In Holland, for example, 5 plants is tolerated, not legal, but tolerated. I think that works. I know that in Colombia, there's a limit of 19 plants.
Wow.
That works as well. But, you know, I would definitely start with allowing people to grow a limited number of plants in their homes in a safe way. You can put some, because in some countries there are worries about safety of grow rooms. That's really easy to tackle. Can just say you allow people to grow indoors, but only with tested equipment. Mm-hmm. There is enough high quality equipment, and also, for example, you could put a limit on the number of watts that the lights can use. You know, say okay, maximum 600 watt lamp, for example. So it is important to think about safety if you allow people to grow indoors. If you just let it go, people might buy bad Chinese imitation stuff and end up setting fire. So I think that's step number one. And then I think actually at the same time as that step, what governments can do is release all cannabis cultivation, for example, up to 1% of THC in the final flower. By doing this, you give big space for the hemp industry, like for fiber, textiles, oil, seed as nutrient for animals or even for humans. This is safe, you know, proven safe, even healthy. It's sustainable. And this is an emerging market around the globe. So I think, you know, if I would be right now in a government, I would put a lot of effort in convincing the rest of the politicians to start as soon as possible to legalize all cannabis up to 1% THC. What naturally comes with giving this totally free is that people will also start to grow flower for smoking with a low THC level. And that's if you just Google for CBD weed, you will find that in Europe and also a little bit in the USA, but mainly in Europe, there's a very big market for this. Not in each country, but just to give you some examples, the UK, France, Germany, Italy, Poland, Czech Republic, all are countries where this kind of flower is legal. Production, by the way, not in all these countries, which is crazy, but the sale and consumption is legal. what happens when you legalize it in this way, especially in Italy, you can see it really well. In Italy, every small town has one or two CBD shops. These shops may sell hemp clothing and, you know, lighters, grinders, and also CBD flour, CBD weed. In Italy, translated, they call the CBD flower, they call it cannabis light, which I think is a nice way to put it. You know, yeah. It's like a light beer or even like alcohol free beer, mm-hmm. but then so I think it's nice. And a lot of listeners who are maybe THC smokers will hear this and they will think this doesn't make sense. This guy is saying that people will smoke weed without THC. I thought exactly the same when the first people started to sell these. I thought, like, why would people buy this product? But I can assure you that when there is given the legal possibility to grow this product, people will start to buy it and consume it, and that can be a booming market. Why is that? Because there are actually a lot of latent cannabis consumers who are maybe a little bit curious but don't really want to get super high. Also, there are a lot of people who do consume cannabis but want to bring down their consumption, mm-hmm. or who, for example, like the effect of rolling a joint, you know, the ritual, the taste, the smell, the effect, but not to get super stoned. So for all those people, by the way, I'm forgetting the people who smoke it as a tobacco alternative. That's also a very good
absolutely.
One. It's way less than tobacco. But still, for people who have the need to smoke something, you know, it can be a replacement. So this is a very interesting segment. And I really think that governments should all over the world start with legalizing CBD flower up to 1%. Why I'm saying 1%, you could also, you know, it's arbitrary. You could also say 0.7 or 0.3 or 0.1. But if there's only 1% of THC, that's still rather low, and low enough not to really make people feel very stoned. In the same time, for the growers, up to 1%, there's a lot of genetics to choose from to grow. When you go further down, the selection of possible genetics to grow will get smaller. Here in Europe, we have some kind of framework that allows us to grow up to 0.2. And then some countries give more freedoms, but 0.2 is like the European number. And that makes the selection of genetics we can use very, very limited. There are not a lot of good cultivars below 0.2. By the way, we're working on that. So I think in 10 years from now that will not apply anymore. There will be much more choice also in the low THC segments. But for the next 4 or 5 years, I expect that it would be still the best to allow people to grow up to 1%. So that would be the step one. And then after that, you know, you will see CBD shops popping up, kind of places to buy weed. There will be menus with amnesia and cookies and everything, but not with THC. Then the society can experience the safest form of recreational cannabis that exists. But, you know, shops can open, the business can evolve, companies can start operating, and it's a very safe way for a country to start experimenting with legalizing cannabis. Then, when this framework is set up, there is an actual cannabis business where there are shops and everything. Consumers know where to go to buy, to purchase legally, but also growers get their experience growing. Then the government can gradually, or in once, but can start also giving the higher THC cultivars some space in the market. And it might be with some restrictions. You know, I can imagine that the government wants to do things step by step. So they could just grant permits to grow to a few of these already established, experienced growers. You know, just pick out like the really responsible companies that are already growing CBD to also grow some THC, or do it in a certain area, you know, like just one province where things might be more liberal than in another one. So then you start in that one province. But if you already have the framework based on the CBD, you already have the actual market distributors. Everything is already in place.
Yeah.
And it will be easy in whichever way, adjust it to the local needs and slowly introduce it. what I've not seen any country doing yet, but I think it would also be an option, is to say like, okay, you know, you have the CBD thing working, then maybe give THC free to everyone, not up to 1%, but up to 3 or 4%. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. See how that goes. 5 years later, if everything is fine, you go up another step, and like that, you expand.
I think that gives a bit of scope to like the healthcare system and people that are concerned, particularly about mental health. I think it gives them the ability to gauge in a very slow, incremental way the impact that it's having on the greater society, and they'll be able to know really, I guess, how far they can go with the THC levels.
Yeah, that's true. And even, you know, the medical appliances of cannabis, by the way, that's some, I see that as something separate. In the same time, it's not separate. But I do think when you build up some kind of framework like this, next to that, you do need to have THC flower available for real medicinal use.
Absolutely.
People with a doctor's description, they should be able to purchase safe, well-cultivated THC cannabis, or if that's not desired, at least grow their own. But preferably, they should be able to get it somewhere. Yeah. And that's separated what I'm speaking about with the other thing is basically for recreational use. Mm-hmm. And there's a really big area between recreational and medicinal. There are a lot of people using cannabis for a combination of factors, you know. The doctor maybe would not give them a prescription, but at the same time, it helps them to sleep good at night, you know. Well, that's some kind of medicinal, right? Depends how you see it. But yeah, it's for people to improve their well-being. Well, those people, they will have to rely on this CBD route, I think. But when doctors decide to prescribe, then everyone should also have access.
I think there's do you believe that mid-range THC, I think there's some data coming out of the US that mid-range THC, when blind studies are done, mid-range THC seems to offer the most enjoyable experience to the consumer. Have you heard much of that, or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, the whole THC debate is going on at the moment. What I can tell you is that sometimes a strain is measured at relatively low THC, let's say 12%, mm-hmm. but still people report it as very strong when they smoke it without knowing the people. And the contrary, there are also strains which are measured very high, like a 25% or more, and consumers don't really experience it as the strongest ever. So the strength or the strength of the effect of a variety definitely doesn't only depend on THC.
Sure.
In the same time, we also know that if there's no THC in a variety, you won't have the psychoactive effect. Mm-hmm. There's no other cannabinoid that really makes you stoned or high as THC does. There is CBN, but CBN actually is corroded THC
it's degraded and converted, hasn't it?
Degraded. So it's actually, it comes from THC.
Yeah.
But the other cannabinoids, CBG, CBD, THCV, and the other ones that we're working on, CBDV, CBC, until now, we did not really experience any psychoactive effects from those alone. But yeah, and then to go back, if we look in Holland, that's an interesting thing. Here in Holland, we have the government testing samples from coffee shops every year. They're actually a research institute who work for the government. And what they've seen is that, let's say, around 2000, the THC was the highest, and the average THC level in flower was, I think, around 18% mm-hmm. when they purchased flower in coffee shops. And after that, it went slightly down again. And if I'm not wrong, I think right now the average is around 15%.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. And Yes, and a lot of people, they in the same time, so we know this, and we also know, you know, when we send samples to labs, depending on how they have been grown, 15% is quite a common result. And still, you see a lot of, and we have strains that often test much higher than that also in the collection, but really not all of them. And we often see our competitors marking all their strains as 28-29% THC. Yeah. But in reality, that can't really reasonably be expected when you are just a simple home grower, only maybe when you have that one cultivar which is actually really high in THC. We have one on our website that it just pops up in my mind right now, but Auto Cinderella Jack, for example, is a strain that each time surprises us when it comes from the lab, but it's just one strain. Many other strains, they will, in normal home grow situation, they will maybe go around 15-16% and not 26-27% like the Auto Cinderella. But I really like to educate people on that. So 15% doesn't mean it's weak.
Yeah,
15% means that it's average or maybe even a little bit above average. If you have 8 or 7% THC strain, then you have something under average, which, by the way, still does the job. 7% is definitely enough to feel the effect, even if you are a daily smoker and are used to smoke. Look, you'll have to smoke a bit more maybe, but even 7% strains do get you high. When you go to 4% or lower, then it's for most smokers just too little. Then there's another group of, that's more new customers, new consumers who want to try it out. And they are often already happy with anything between 1 and 4% to start, to get experience.
Sure.
And also, for example, people who don't smoke that often, you know, if you smoke just once every month or something like that, then maybe you like to enjoy the joint, but you don't want to get too high. So then it's nicer to be able to smoke a whole joint of 4% if the taste is good, because often low THC weed also isn't the best tasting. But if the taste is good, the 4% is fine, even maybe better than the 20% joint, because from the 20% joint, after 2 or 3 hits, maybe you're done already.
Yeah, so one interesting thing with that in terms of the legalization steps that you've sort of proposed, I think it's far safer for a first-time user, like you've just mentioned, to have access to a low THC variety legally. Like there are always going to be people in society that are curious and want to try cannabis. We're never going to get rid of that. So I find it far safer to have that option legal, clean, trusted source. It's a far better option than them going to their mate's mate who grows in 4 bedrooms in a house in a highly questionable environment with highly questionable nutrients, pesticides, fungicides going into that plant.
Yeah, definitely. Italy is the best example. Italy gave giving space to people to grow anything up to 0.6% THC. If you Google it, you will find a lot of companies offering that product. And what you see in Italy is that they developed a whole cannabis industry based on that, where people grow organically. They grow, in a bit larger scale, but there are also craft growers who grow maybe a couple of hundred plants. But it's legal, you know, so the police comes to check, everything is fine. The authorities know who they are and where they are and what they do. So it's a very good first step towards further legalization. I think Italy is really showing the lead in this sense.
It's interesting. I haven't heard a lot about Italy, but they keep coming up lately. It seems like, is this just in the last couple of years that they've made these changes?
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, Italy always has been a country where a lot of people grow at home, but it was heavily prosecuted for a long time. So, for example, we did sell seeds there. Seeds are legal in Italy, have always been. But for collection purposes, as you know. So we did have a market there, but it was all, we sold to legal companies who sold it to the growers, but then it went quite underground. And over the, let's say, the last 5 years, a lot changed in Italy. There was actually a guy, his name is Luca Marolo, I think. Anyway, funny guy, friendly guy from Italy, and he figured that he could actually sell hemp flour. And hemp flour in that time, you know, there are a lot of definitions of hemp, right? But in Italy at that time, a hemp flour was like a super fluffy flour with leaves still on it, with no taste whatsoever, apart from like some kind of forest taste, and seeds inside. So really the last thing you would think of, like something nice to smoke. But this guy, I don't know why, he came up with the idea to put these flowers in a jar and sell them in his shop. And he actually managed to sell a shitload of that stuff. He got interviewed by a national newspaper, which even pushed him further. And suddenly his brand of hemp flowers was all over the country. So the law didn't change. It was just this one crazy guy with the crazy idea, which no one ever gave a chance inside our industry, which changed the landscape completely in Italy. People saw his success, and he himself also, and started to improve those flowers. You know, and us too, we when we saw this happening, we were like, wow, we need low THC strains for this market so they can get better flowers than these fluffy seed-filled hemp flowers. So that's when the local Italians and us and other people started to work on better genetics. And right now, you can buy on, well, not literally, but almost every street corner, there's a CBD shop in Italy where you can buy CBD flowers, which smell and taste like good flowers you would buy in a coffee shop in Amsterdam.
That's really interesting. I've spent a fair bit of time in the Czech Republic, and it's quite similar. Like all of the, in Czech, they call it tabaks, all of the newspaper stands, they hold CBD varieties. There's CBD dispensaries, and it's it seems very safe and very accepted.
Yeah, this thing actually spread from Italy to a lot of other countries. By the way, Switzerland, which borders with Italy also, very short after this guy came with this crazy idea to sell these flowers, Switzerland legalized anything up to 1% THC. So a lot of development has been going on in Switzerland as well, and you've seen the same thing going on over there. But from those two countries, Italy and Switzerland, it kind of spread all over Europe to not all countries, but most countries have now people selling the CBD flower. Some only on internet, the others have physical shops like Czech Republic. There's a whole CBD flower market in Europe, which is just growing year after year. Last February, I was in Rome, and a lot of growers were telling me that, you know, to go back even a bit more back in time, let's say 1 year ago from now, a lot of people were saying, okay, this year the Italians are growing too much, because we were selling seeds a lot, but, you know, we also know what our competitors are doing and how big the plantations are. And there were some grows that were so massive that we thought, like, okay, this year they're growing too much. The price is going to vanish next year, you know. It's going to, and a lot of people must go bankrupt. That's what we believed 1 year ago. But I was wrong, with me, quite some people. Actually, during the corona crisis, the online sales of the higher quality CBD flowers exploded. So it's really difficult to still find a good quality CBD wheat in Italy at this moment.
Yeah, okay. Sold out.
Everyone is out of stock.
Wow, that's quite interesting. Yeah, I like that the general public, people are making conscious decisions. You know, it's not all about like, let's just get as stoned as possible, let's find the highest THC possible. I think it's sort of demonstrates that the public are interested in safer alternatives and less psychoactive alternatives. Yeah. And I think that allows the individual the opportunity to determine themselves exactly what they can and can't take.
I even heard that like the typical street dealers in cities like Rome in Italy, who are used to sell illegal THC flower, now and other drugs, you know, those guys are they don't care if it's heroin or weed, but even those guys added CBD flower now to their portfolio because their customers are also changing from regular cannabis to CBD cannabis. That's so cool. Even the illegal people have to add some legal products to their...
that's crazy, isn't it? It's almost like a street dealer selling Panadol. that's quite funny. I think, do you feel that you suggested that maybe each individual household is allowed a limited number of plants. Do you feel there would be a risk of a flooding of the market, or do you feel that the individuals would then effectively just cultivate for their own consumption and it could do a fair bit of damage to black market sales and thus take away some of the dodgy characters from the landscape?
That really depends on how you organize that. If you let people grow, for example, 50 plants in their house, then they can grow enough to supply dealers, to say it like that, or even shops if it's legal or whatever. I think anything up to 10 plants would not really be enough to consistently supply a black market dealer. For example, here in Holland, we have 5 plants. That's the example I know closest. And Chile has 6 plants. It's very comparable. Czech Republic also has 5 plants. And I think I like the option from Chile the most. In Chile, they say 4 or 6 plants. Or if it's indoors, 1 square meter, then if you keep it in 1 square meter, then the number of plants doesn't matter.
That's quite interesting. That's cool.
Like to grow like small plants on a square meter, that's possible there. So I think that's the best option, 6 plants or 1 square meter maximum.
Yeah, that's really
more
interesting.
Would be 1 meter. But anyway, so or surface or number of plants. But, you know, if you are realistic with 5 plants or 1 square meter, you're never going to be a real supplier to a black market organization. You could sell it all and get some money, but then the amounts are never going to be that interesting that you can give up your day job, and also the quantities are never interesting enough for those organizations to really set up different growths of this scale. For them it's too small, so that's a way to keep those things separated. I think if you grow 6 plants or 1 square meter, you definitely have enough for your own consumption and maybe to share with your friends, maybe to sell a gram here and there, but not to really do business with it. So I think that would be a reasonable number. If you grow 5 or 6 plants outdoors, especially if you live in a good climate and you are a really good grower, of course you can get a shitload of weed from it.
Yes, in but Australia, I think, yes, that's possible.
Yeah, oh, definitely. But then it's once a year, you know, and okay, once a year you have several kilos of wheat, but it's not a replacement for a job. And I think that is a big thing to consider. You know, when you let people grow that much plants that they could live off it, then you create kind of a black market system where a lot of people become small growers.
Yeah, I like
that. But, you know, 5 or 6 plants is not going to be enough for giving up your job.
I like the concept of that limited plant number, individual household cultivation. Do you think this is something that the governments could look at, like licensing and taxing in some way? Do you think there's a method that could be applied there?
No, that would be a massive mistake. They tried it in Uruguay, in Latin America, the first country to actually legalize cannabis, but with a lot of restrictions. So I wouldn't really actually call it legalization what they did there. But there, it's also a bureaucratic company or a country, you know, not really comparable, I think, to Australia or the Netherlands. But there, they made a legal framework in which people have to go to the post office, which is a state organization there. People have to go to the local post office. They have to apply for being a home grower. Then they will get their permit. And once they have their permit, then they can grow at home. Practically nobody is applying for that, and people are just growing.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And now it's like, if you if you want to grow tomatoes, you also don't want the government permission for that.
Yeah.
You don't want it. It's in your private place, you know. It's in your own house. You of course, if you have to build a big extension to your house, one time you ask for permission. I think those things are reasonable. This is just a hobby thing. You do in your own house. You don't want to be known by the authorities for doing this.
I think one thing, though, is that there's always going to be a portion of the voter base, the population, that want to say, well, how's the country going to benefit from this, and where are they going to get, how are we going to make money from this? Yeah. So there's always people that are financially motivated, and there's quite a large portion of the population that are financially motivated. So where do you feel governments could access some form of taxation or tariff to try and boost society? So, you know, we want to be able to present this industry, if it were to roll out and be legalized, we want to be able to present it as something that improves our society. Somehow money goes to schools, goes to mental health facilities and hospitals. Where do you see an area that governments could look at to generate that sort of income?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, first of all, I don't really know the Australian situation that well, but I do know other countries. First of all, there is, in a lot of countries, there's the police is against legalization. And in my opinion, that is mainly motivated by them losing funding. Yes. For, you know, work. And politicians really have to see through that, because what that actually means is that the police will have less work if cannabis is legalized.
Yeah,
which
absolutely.
Is a massive saving for government. If I think, I suppose that in Australia there's also some kind of registration of, let's say, of like which reasons the police act on. And probably you will see that quite a considerable percentage of the work of the police involves cannabis.
Absolutely, yes.
If you would only cut out if you would only legalize possession of a small amount of cannabis, probably only that step will already free up quite some of the police force, which is a saving for the government. So by legalizing, for example, just home growing, with that goes certain possession limits, you know, what you grow at home, you should also be able to possess that, otherwise it doesn't make sense. There are some countries who forgot to do that, which is crazy. But, you know, if the possession and the home growing is just completely allowed, the police can focus on more important things, or you could just cut in police budgets. Don't tell them, because they will not be happy, but it would be an option.
So you see it as a reallocation of taxpayer dollars. So the funds are already there. You're just saying that they can be used in better ways.
Yeah, and it's about serious money. Yeah? In the Netherlands, I think about 3 years ago, there was a study done about that. Like, what would cannabis legalization bring us in terms of savings and in extra income? Well, just in saving on police, but it's not just police. Eh? It's prisons. It's judges. It's also just they are hiring super expensive specialized companies to empty the grow rooms when they discover one in Holland, because here large scale growing is still not legal. So anyway, there's a whole infrastructure of prosecution of cannabis, and that whole infrastructure can be dismantled. And that was in according to that study about 2 billion euros in the Netherlands, which is a super tiny country.
Yeah.
So maybe you would be looking at something comparable or even bigger over there. Additionally, the extra income, you know, that really depends. That depends on how you organize things. With just home growing, of course, you can't really generate extra income from that as a government. You know, I'm sure that some kind of permit system won't work. You know, people are not going to register to grow at home. Anyways, if you know that your neighbor has a permit to grow, and the other, and you also want to grow, you just do it. You know.
Okay, yeah.
You know, he's not going to jail. Whatever. So people are not going to do that. So in order to generate further income, then the CBD structure I just mentioned, allowing up to 1%, that could create a whole new industry, which can be taxed just like any other industry.
Sure.
And if you like, you can put some extra tax on cannabis. It's an option. I'm not really in favor of that, not because I don't want the government to have that money, because I think they deserve money to build roads and stuff like that. But if you would put extra tax on top of like normal standard value-added tax that's on any product, you could run the risk that the cannabis gets too expensive and people try to buy it still on the black market, or you know, to look for alternatives. And that's something that should be monitored also. You know, when you start legalizing in whichever way, monitor the black market, find people with that knowledge, and see what the prices on the black market are doing and how that compares to the shop prices. If the black market prices go down, that's actually a good thing. You know, then you'll know that there's competition from the legal market to the black market. The black market always needs more margin than the legal market, because there's like a certain risk involved. So in the end, if the legal market is big enough, then there always comes a point in which the black market doesn't make sense anymore. Then in Europe, for example, we have an extra dimension that if one country does that, there's still always export market. So maybe you could achieve kind of killing the black market, but it would still be interesting to grow illegally large scale for export to another European country, which is super easier. Take the car, you go. But you don't really have that situation. I don't think it would be really easy for you guys to export to Europe, for example.
I don't think so, no.
Anyway, no. So I think, you know, monitor that. And cannabis shouldn't become too cheap, you know. Just you wouldn't also want to have beer on sale for 20 cents. Same counts for wheat, you know. You don't want the gram to be sold for 20 cents. But if there's some kind of price level which relates well to the black market, is not higher, then I think you're okay.
That's really cool. That's great insight. Mm. I've really enjoyed hearing that, actually.
Yeah.
Adam, we've got Adam joining us today. Paul's sitting on the sidelines with this chat. Adam, you got anything you'd like to ask Yaoki?
Yeah, I would. You talk about like the benefits of legalizing and taking those steps. What are like some examples of countries that have tried to legalize, but it's kind of backfired on them, or like the bad things that have happened from legalizing?
Good question. I think I wouldn't know any country where you could really say that it backfired on them.
Yep.
I do know examples of countries where their mistakes were made. Actually, I do not know any country that did not make a mistake. That's normal, because, you know, there are not that many examples yet. And each country has their own specific situation, so it's also not like that situation of one country can be simply applied to another one. Each culture is different, people are different, the situation around cannabis is different. So there's just not one way to do it, and I think there will never be one way to do it. Just like with alcohol, you know, alcohol is also being treated different in different countries.
Yep.
You know, there's a lot to be learned. So, for example, in Canada, there are a lot of lessons from Canada, and Canada is also the best example of how you can legalize cannabis. They have the most experience. They are a developed country where you can really see, you know, how some things could be done and also how some things should not be done. I think one of the mistakes of Canada was only allowing big companies with deep pockets to start growing cannabis. And now they are trying to justify that with craft growing licenses, so small-scale grow operation licenses. And those companies have less strict rules to follow than the big ones. But what we see in reality right now, nowadays in Canada, there are a lot of companies who invested a lot of money because they had to comply with so much rules, and also everybody wanted to be the most professional one and, you know, the most prestigious one. So people were building super expensive facilities, partially based on government regulation, but partially also more like showing off. And they are not making the money they counted they would, because that's what happened. What's going to happen if you legalize? A lot of entrepreneurs are going to be counting. They know what a gram of wheat costs now on the street. They also know how much it costs theoretically to grow cannabis. So they're going to be sitting down. They're going to count on a piece of paper. They're going to make a sheet, and they are going to think like, shit, I can make millions of euros in one grow operation with little effort. They're going to invest massively, and they're going to realize that actually growing wheat is also a profession, and that it's not just money, and that it's not that easy to make a lot of money. Now, a lot of examples are there of companies who are now losing money or having to close production facilities or having to restructure or even restructure several times, purchase companies abroad and now are selling those again. So, you know, I would prefer to start in somewhat small and then step by step scale up, and not in one say, okay, from this date you have, I don't know, 100 licenses for big funded companies to start working, because it's going to lose a lot of money for people, and that's not what anyone wants, I think. Also, a lot of governments, they try, not a lot, but there are quite some governments who try to cut out anyone who has like experience in the gray area or illegal cannabis industry. It's going to work, because who are the people that know the cannabis consumers, who are the people know how to grow cannabis, which is a profession, you know? It's not just something any tomato grower can do, really not. So, you know, don't cut out the actually underground movement. You know, the governments have to realize if they legalize, they are legalizing an activity that was illegal, but the people that were doing it were not doing it because they are criminals or because it was illegal. They were doing it because they like it. If a government is smart enough to realize that this was a mistake, it should not have been illegal, they should also use the knowledge, the experience that there is from the underground gray area movement and bring that above the ground. In the same time, it also gives a chance for those people to kind of legalize what they've been doing, you know? So I'm not saying that they should just let any criminal get away with what they've been doing. You know, a big-time dealer is a big-time dealer, and that's illegal. But a passionate grower who has been growing in his basement for 20 years, he is the guy you would want to grow in a craft-growing or a company next to a professional tomato grower, you know? You need to combine professional knowledge with underground knowledge.
Yeah.
If you miss one of the two, then it's going to be really hard.
Yeah, you can't cut out the expertise. Sorry, you can't cut out the expertise. I mean, it's essential. Mm,
definitely.
It's something that is often, very often being underestimated. But if a country already has a long-established growing culture, and I think all Western countries do have that, then you need that. Because those are the people who know the consumer. If you get let's say Coca-Cola growing wheat with all guys in suits who have no clue about cannabis, they're going to grow some kind of cannabis that nobody wants. That's for sure, you know. If you have the guy that was already growing for the existing market before, he knows what people want, how it should look, smell, etc.
And that
knowledge is much undervaluated often before legalizing, and after legalizing the government start to realize they are missing that part of the expertise.
That's really cool.
Yeah,
I think that's been an awesome chat. Yeah, okay. That's an eye-opener. I think it's a great one for our listeners as well, because it's something they can think about afterwards. They can go through their own mind of how they would roll it out, and they've learned a lot from somebody that has seen the world and seen the world in this industry. You've seen so many methods, and as you say, no country got everything right when they've rolled things out. So you've seen the lessons that people have learned. And I think it's invaluable information that you've just given us, mate.
Okay. Well, happy to be here and happy to explain stuff to you guys.
Right. That's always a pleasure. Once again, thank you for joining us, Jaoke.
Yeah.
Very cool, mate. Thank you for enlightening our listeners a bit more and teaching us a bit about the way that we can perhaps pursue things in the future.
Good luck with that.
Cheers, mate. Thanks, Yake. Take care, bud.
See ya.
Ciao, ciao. Bye.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Cantor. Any guest views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the guests and not necessarily those of the hosts. Cantor strongly suggests listeners research local, state, and federal laws and regulations before conducting any cannabis-related activity.